You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. Our next speaker is Ian Bowl, a contributor to a new book on the rise of the anti-corporate globalization movement titled The Battle of Seattle. He spoke last week in Ithaca. The first thing you'll hear is an introduction of Professor Bowl by Barry Maxwell of the Comparative Literature Department at Cornell University.
Ian Bowl joins us tonight from Berkeley, California, where he is affiliated with the Department of Geography at the University of California at Berkeley. As a social historian of science and technics, and as an engaged and, as I've seen, enraged member of several communities, Ian has made important interventions into large-scale and small-scale processes, some of long-standing, that make people miserable. One of these interventions is his contribution of a glossary to the anthology The Battle of Seattle, about which we'll hear tonight. Ian Bowl's essays that have accumulated in scholarly and popular publications detail, quote, the long struggle of the common people to escape from a servile life into the freedom of just conditions, unquote. He will, I hope, explain to you the source of that particular language tonight. Ian is the co-editor with James Brooke of Resisting the Virtual Life, The Culture and Politics of Information from City Lights Press. Cornell University Press recently published his essay, Damaging Crops, an account of the movements of resistance against the privatization of the world's germplasm, in a volume entitled Violent Environments. Ian has also co-written with Michael Watts a major critical evaluation of the work of the photographer Sebastião Salgado, which appeared in issue 68 of the journal Transition. His essays appear in two volumes from City Lights Books, War After War, 1992, and a volume with a title that really we have to remember, First World, Ha Ha Ha, The Zapatista Challenge, 1995. And from City Lights, we can also look forward to the publication of Ian's consuming project of the last many years, a study of enclosures past and present titled The Long Theft. Before I close and bring Ian up, I want to thank Jack Goldman very much for organizing this evening on short notice and Marion Gannat for really organizing this event on short notice. So thank you very much. Join me in welcoming Ian Bowl.
Thank you, Barry, for that eloquent introduction, and thank you to the bookery and to Jack for making this possible. I've been a long-time subscriber to the Book Press, which is one of the glories of Ithaca, and it reaches out a long way, and I know that there are many people who've, like myself, enjoyed the arrival of the Book Press. I remember in particular a wonderful essay on the Peter projection from years ago, and a tremendous conversation with Ben Anderson, and the fact that it was a venue for Martin Bernal to enable to reply to his critics. These are important spaces, even though they come from small towns like Ithaca. What I think I'll do is just talk rather briefly and maybe read a few short items from the glossary, and then we can kind of start a conversation. Let me just say something about my part in the book. I'm a longtime friend of Eddie Ewan. Perhaps even he would call me some kind of mentor, but we're friends and comrades. And Eddie's the main editor. George Katsiafikas is the more senior, a very interesting scholar at UMass who now lives in Korea most of the time, well known for a tremendous study of the German Autonomen movement called The Subversion of Politics, and it's a book that I would strongly recommend. And the third editor is Daniel Burton Rose, who I first met as a very young boy. I became friends with his father, who's a lonely classicist working in Ohio, one of the few Marxian classicists. Daniel's godmother, this is a great pedigree, is Candace Falk, the keeper of Emma Goldman's flame. And so some of these things are, there's some genealogy here. Now, there was a crisis as the book went to press, and of course it was the crisis of September. And Eddie and I worked on the introduction, what we could do about the fact that history seemed, for a few weeks at least, to have stopped in September, and it was unclear whether the book even was going to be the kind of vade mecum for the anti-globalist and antinomian left that we had hoped. And I think the preface that goes with the introduction registers a structure of feeling in those weeks after September that in a sense is already past. And I say that because I think the important thing that one gets from the Battle of Seattle, one of the crucial things, the functions that it has, I think, is again to give some historical context to it, to show that although Seattle has become iconic in a way for the movement, in the way that, you know, May 68 is, or Soweto for the struggle in South Africa, Seattle, of course, was really only just, in a certain sense, the beginning in North America. There's a very interesting map that's been reproduced here, which tries to show the movement, if it is, maybe we should say movements, in a global context. And the map is interesting because Seattle looks kind of rather isolated. I can't even locate it here. But when you look at the map, you see that, in fact, that one can say that this movement began certainly, of course, long before Seattle, maybe even as early as the first riots in the face of the IMF structural adjustments of the late 70s. That is to say that what we call Thatcherism or Reaganism really began to have its devastating effect on the ground in the late 70s and the early 80s. One of the things I'm interested in is tracing back neoliberalism to its roots. And I have an entry that I might read from the glossary in which I raise the question of the genesis of this fantastic view in which the market takes on a life of its own at whatever expense. As far as the glossary is concerned, Donald Nicholson Smith, a friend of mine, and some of you might know him as the superb translator of Guy Debord, Donald, in an all-night session at Dan Coughlin and Elizabeth Benjamin's place in Manhattan, said that when I was talking about the theoretical basis of the very idea of a critical glossary and what an attention to language means and why it's important, suggested when I told him what I thought I was doing here that I actually write a kind of preface to it to make that clear. And I did that, and in a way I'm glad I did it because it clarified for me what it was that I got from my own mentor, the Welsh critic Raymond Williams. And it was Williams who, I think in the 1950s even, he went to the, many of you will perhaps know his work, but he went to the Tribune, which was the, I think, the weekly or certainly fortnightly journal of the sort of left of the British Labour Party. And he went to them and he said, there's a very interesting thing about the English language, that it's unlike, say French or German or the sort of other daughters of Latin, that it's actually a Creole. It has, you know, two parts to it. One is the old sort of Anglo-Saxon, the kind of way that George Orwell wants us to speak, only in words of one syllable. And the other is this large Latinate vocabulary sort of that's come on top. And it registers, of course, the arrival at the Norman conquest of Norman French. And being a Welshman, Raymond Williams noticed that, say, trade unionists and others, proletarians especially, who come onto the BBC, found themselves embarrassed to use the analytic language required to analyze, you know, the current situation, whenever that might be. And so Raymond Williams went to the Tribune and said, I want to do a column in which I take the key words that we need for the self-clarification and understanding of the movements of resistance. For those of us who intend harm to this system, we need to to understand the way in which language is being used against us. Because, of course, any time we are inclined to start an essay which goes something like, "The Oxford English Dictionary says," Raymond would get all kind of upset and say, you know, well, dictionary definitions, they're just congealed ideology, you know. And, of course, you know this is true because, I mean, some of you might remember the case of Baby M. I don't know if you remember Baby M. It was a kind of tug of not so much love, but there was a struggle over this baby that was a working-class single woman who rented out her womb to a middle-class couple, and she decided to keep the child. And there was a struggle over what counted as mother, who was the mother, you know. Going to the dictionary, Raymond said, was an absurd business because, of course, the dictionary simply registers the victory of some particular version, in this case of motherhood, over another, whether the biological mother or the surrogate mother. Notice that in the press, it was the working-class woman who was called the surrogate. Why was that the case, right? In fact, of course, the victory went to those... I mean, in other words, the contract was honored. It was the middle-class woman whose only connection to the baby, of course, was through the spermatic economy of the father. So Williams was very attentive to the sort of the sedimentation in language. And so I think it comes out of being a student of Williams that I decided to write a glossary to the Battle of Seattle, because it seems to me, again, as I said in the introduction, that far too often the left, as it were, is retorting in an idiom, I say, satisfactory to the sovereign. Just reading a bit from the introduction here. Raymond Williams' explorations in historical semantics are much the better known, but his keywords was anticipated a generation earlier by Kenneth Burke, when he launched a critique of the left political lexicon in the face of corporate fascist reaction to capital's big 20th century emergency. Burke recommended intellectual vagabondage that would constitute what he called a grave interference with the cultural code of industrial modernity. He proposed sabotage of the system by defending inefficiency, pessimism, dissipation, mockery, distrust, hypochondria, and treason. One communist called Burke's negative aesthetic, quote, "the philosophy of the petty bourgeoisie gone mad," and Burke didn't much disagree. Then in April 1935, at the time of the Popular Front and the Bienio Negro in Spain, Burke gave a brief address to the first American Writers' Congress in New York, and the title of his essay was "Revolutionary Symbolism in America." He told his audience that when they weren't talking into the mirror, they were using a patronizing language that was sure to fail, simply because idealizing the workers in the same breath as insisting on the absolute degradation of work under capitalism was a rhetorical disaster. Burke went on to recommend the people rather than workers as a mode of address, even though he was quite aware that in a society riven by hierarchies of class, gender, race, and the rest, the people has its own problems, to say the least. Any totalizing term is necessarily ideological. So hostile was the reaction, he was accused actually of proposing the rhetorical methods of Hitler, that Burke later hallucinated excrement dripping from his tongue. Another totalization, there is none greater, stamped the days of Seattle, both on the streets and in the suites. I mean, of course, the Globe and its derivatives, under which sign the committees of capital and their opponents converged. The Globe's interesting, right? Because notice the NASA Earthscape. A highly technocratic symbol in some ways, but one which is also used very widely by the environmental movement. And one of the questions I think we need to ask ourselves is, what is it about a symbol that is used both by, say, Mobil Oil in their self-presentation of the object world of capital, and by their putative opponents, the NGOs and the environmental movement? Is this one of those cases where you have, in this case, an image rather than some term of art or a word in the lexicon, which it's absolutely vital to contest? Some words, I suggest, we should let go. And I say we because I'm addressing those in the audience, the sort of comrades in the audience here. There may be some of those who would disagree about this, but it seems to me that there are some words which we are happy to let go. and some which it's absolutely vital that we understand that it's absolutely crucial to contest. What about the globe? You know, this is an interesting question about the earthscape, right? Because it's, if you like, a militarized view of the earth. It's a NASA view. We're invited to think of this as our home. What kinds of people are we that identify the entire globe as home? And what about those inhabitants of the earth on seeing this image, with no trace of humanity on it, mind you, might decide, no, I cannot identify with that whole thing as home. The fact that there is no trace of humanity itself is rather interesting, because it seems to me to play into the most profound trope of American environmentalism, which is to say the wilderness. And when Barry, in his kind introduction, said that I have been active in the struggle against the privatization of the germplasm and the struggle in Britain against genetically modified crops. One of the key differences in the environmental movement here and in Europe is that here the other to the city is not a settled countryside, but absolute wilderness. This is why Ansel Adams airbrushed out any trace of humanity from his photographs. It's why I think the space of agriculture in North America is entirely different from the way that it's figured in the European imagination. And I don't particularly want to defend the British idea of the countryside in the romantic, you know, the village with the sleepy village with the squire and the church spire and the smoke drifting up. You know, I mean, this is not anything that we want to feel desperately wedded to, but it is very interesting to compare these two imaginaries. And I think it's relevant to this example I'm using of the globe and globalization, of course, being key central terms in this struggle. And what is it when we identify with the globe? Because after all, it's a globalization is a process that begins in the business schools. It's a term that emerges in the American business schools in the late 70s, early 80s. And what would it mean to sort of turn that around? Our kind of globalization, what do we want? Maybe I'll finish, after I've read a few of these entries, with a few words from the essay by James O'Connor on that. So under environmentalists, I have this entry. Environmentalists. Corporate capital stormy petrels warning of bad weather. That mobile and environmentalist both like to operate under the sign of NASA's whole Earth image reveals how green politics is a version of global managerialism. The Malthusian assumptions and the eugenic and racist roots of environmentalism, that is to say, population control, native plant fanaticism, defense of wilderness that was someone else's home, are barely below the surface. Now, that may be unfair, but the point about a Ambrose Bierceian glossary is that you're allowed to be unfair. It's supposed to get us kind of thinking and talking here. The entry under globalization goes this way. Business school jargon that gained general currency in the 90s only to describe the dismantling of barriers to the movement of capital and the loss of local and national sovereignties to the interests of transnational firms, helped along by developments in telecommunications and the collapse of the two-block world. Globes were originally emblems of sovereignty. That's a definition from 1614. That became playthings of merchant princes and navigators, familiar as props in Renaissance portraiture. It was the task of cartography to project the globe into two dimensions. Without the resulting maps and charts, the business of empire and planetary capitalist hegemony would be literally unthinkable. I think I'll read three or four more. Of course, again, a key term in the title and the subtitle of the book, globalization for one. Here's the entry under corporation. Again, it's an interesting question. Those of us who would want to prefigure a more ample and a better world and intend harm to this system have to ask ourselves, is any version of incorporation of a corporate body to be shunned? Corporation. from corpus, body. The body of the Catholic Church was the Ur Corporation, as the monastery was the prototype for other key institutions in the West, the asylum, the hospital, the university, the factory. By a legal fiction, the business corporation was given a deathless personality, an idea related to the theory of the divine right of kings, by which the monarch has two bodies, one that decays, one that doesn't. That's why on the death of the queen, or queen mother, you're going to get, the queen is dead, long live the king. There can be no discontinuity. Of course, I was brought up being told that the English Republic, there was an English Republic for 11 years, was merely an interregnum, a regrettable hiccup in the glorious pageant of the monarchy. The laws of the corporation inversely mirror the laws of criminal conspiracy. When individuals combine in pursuit of capital, they're afforded more protection than they enjoy in their own persons. That's to say, things like limits to liability, both criminal and civil, special treatment with taxation, and so forth. When individuals combine against capital, they have less protection than they have on their own. Mere association is criminalized, since the very act of combining is seen as a threat. That is, two or more people agreeing to commit a misdemeanor, whether they ever or not go through with it, is considered by the state a felony, because the greater threat is the sheer coming together in opposition to those interests the state serves. That's corporation. On the same page here, I see community and democracy. These are two terms maybe we don't want to let go. So community is interesting because I call it the maximum shibboleth, a mantra used affirmatively across the entire political and cultural spectrum. NPR once interviewed a spokesman from the, quote, organized crime community. There's an implied antithesis to the state, with suggestions of power, authority, and central decision in favor of the local and the face-to-face. The results can be grotesque. The release of asylum and hospital inmates to the community often means, in reality, warm ventilation grates. The communitarian right would rather nobody noticed that the shattering of communities is a direct effect of capital moving away in obedience to the logic of the very system they endorse. I have a brief entry under democracy. It goes like this. Democracy, a system of periodic ratification of political masters by ballot. Meanwhile, the major decisions, who, whom, for what, how, remain in the hands of the few. Democracy is the ideological keystone of the West's charter myth, and historically consistent by its own account with slavery, that's Athens, with monarchy, say England, and plutocracy, United States. Development, and again, when I read the paragraph from Jim O'Connor's essay towards the very end of the Battle of Seattle, if we hold this question of development in our minds, what kind of development do we want? Of course, the left, if one can use the term at all without smiling, is quite split on the question of development. And I suppose the lines of Fisher are the ones that divide typically Marxists from anarchists, in the sense that Marxists are really the unruly siblings of the Enlightenment. As you know, Marx himself thrilled to the sound of the machinery of the factories. Because, of course, he believed that in order to get from the realm of necessity into the realm of freedom, that you need the means of production, you need that big machinery. In that sense, he didn't really problematize the means of production. And in The Long Theft, in my forthcoming book, it's really at its heart, apart from an analysis of enclosures, old and new, is a meditation on the machinery question, as it was called in 1800. And development, of course, is a key term which has taken over from improvement, which was the banner under which the parliamentary enclosures took place, the expropriation of the peasantries. happened early on under the sign of improvement, development, perhaps the key term of modernity, drawing, as it does, into a single nexus the discourses of real estate, of childhood, and of colonialism for the future realization of added value. By the colonization of infancy and the infantilization of the colonies, labor and land, human and natural capital, are made ready for improvement. The older word that development replaced, etymologically derived from pros, meaning profit. So improvement means to render profitable. And the key insight of the great book by Karl Polanyi, The Great Transformation, I think one of the central insights was to understand that what we have to deal with in particular is what he called fictitious commodities. There are commodities that are produced for the market. In fact, capitalism, under one of its construals, can be seen as the system that is centered around the production of commodities by commodities. I mean, it's a formulation that leaves out exploitation directly, but nevertheless, I think it's helpful to think about it. What Polanyi analyzed was the situation under which certain commodities, so-called, are not really commodities. In what sense is the land produced? It's treated as a commodity, but it is not. In what sense is water a commodity? And that led me to an investigation of the roots of neoliberal dogma and took me back to this strange character called Ronald Coase, an English accountant, who first formulated the absolute regnancy of the market, a world in which there is no public space left, that the commons has completely disappeared, that exchange relations are absolutely dominant and universal. It's an amazing vision, and so bizarre was it that even people as extreme as Milton Friedman, for heaven's sake, was astounded to hear Coase formulate this one evening. This is an evening that's gone into the folklore of the right, of the far economic right, who are now, you know, taken to be somehow mainstream, banal, you know, presuppositions of current economic doctrine. That was not the case in 1950, when Ronald Coase formulated his view that one could do without any public goods whatsoever, that everything should be brought to market. And it's for that reason that I have an entry, particularly under Coase or Coase's theorem, which is really at the roots of neoliberal doctrine, which, if you like, is the ideology under which the anti-globalization movements have to operate. Coase's theorem. The notorious December 1991 World Bank memo written by Lawrence Summers, later US Treasury Secretary and later still President of Harvard, argued that, quote, the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable. Because, quote, underpopulated countries in Africa are vastly underpolluted. Their air quality is probably vastly inefficiently low compared to Los Angeles or Mexico City. I mean, think about it. Yeah. It's under this logic that the life of an inhabitant of the global south actuarially is worth much less than a life in the north. Why? Because of foregone expectable income if they die young. It's that kind of logic. I'm trying to get you slowly into the Coasean logic here. Brazil's Secretary of the Environment wrote to Summers about the leaked memo, quote, your reasoning is perfectly logical but totally insane, and was fired soon after. The reasoning referred to was in fact a pure example of the logic behind Coase's theorem. And this is, I believe, is the most quoted paper, the problem of social cost, the most quoted paper in the whole of the discipline of economics, which says a lot about the discipline of economics. Coase's theorem, which relates market efficiency, property, transaction costs, and externalities, what you and I might call pollution. and underpins much of neoliberal legal and economic doctrine, as well as WTO and IMF policies. Ronald Coase is the economist responsible for tradable pollution rights by dreaming of a world of zero transaction costs, where everything can be smoothly brought to market, and no ethical distinction made between the harm done by an oil refinery to those living downwind and the harm done to its owners by downwinders being in the way. This is the true moral obscenity, that those living downwind next to an oil refinery are on the same playing field, according to Coase. It's just a question of finding the curve where the cost and benefit match. In other words, the oil refinery will be willing to pay a certain amount to pollute, and there's a certain amount of money that the downwinders will be prepared to accept for the pollution. The fact that, of course, this means foregone life expectancy and so forth is beside the point. It's just a cost-benefit matter requiring only clear and absolute private property rights, no common goods, and enough police to enforce them. The World Bank's impeccable Coasean logic means that there is no right, and you must understand, this is a very important point here. The World Bank's impeccable Coasean logic means that there is no right under this economic doctrine to clean water, to clean air, to clean soil, but merely the right to pay to keep them clean if they are, or to be compensated for their fouling. Too bad, of course, about those not at the bargaining table, above all the unborn or the stillborn generations. Luckily, economists have long prepared us to discount the future. Coase once said that the future valuation of property was put at risk by, quote, and this is Coase himself speaking in the 1950s, was put at risk by, quote, such cataclysmic events as the abolition of slavery. Coase won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1991. Why was the abolition of slavery a cataclysmic event? Because, of course, it was about the destruction of private property, of chattel slavery. And indeed, we know that at the time of the Civil War, there was active discussion about the compensation of masters for the loss of property, for the takings, as it would now be called. I think I'll just finish with a couple. I wasn't going to touch this one, but I think because of the events of last week, I think I should. Let me finish with the entry under anarchist and under terrorism, and to the extent that they're related in complex ways, ideologically and otherwise. Anarchist. Pierre Joseph, property as theft, Proudhon, was among the first to embrace this term of abuse. Roger's thesaurus places it in the company of terrorist, savage, and fanatic. But peaceable anarchists, in the tradition of William Godwin, Pierre Kropotkin, and Emma Goldman, have greatly outnumbered advocates of negotiation by dynamite, which remains the specialty of governments. Still, anarchists have understood that however much they carry in their hearts a world organized on principles of mutual aid and free association, the current owners show no signs of leaving quietly. And for that reason, Durruti once remarked, "The bourgeoisie may blast and ruin their own world before they leave the stage of history. We are not in the least afraid of ruins." If the tactics of Seattle's Enragés, the symbolic breaking of corporate property, showed one masked face of anarchism, the other was the classic anarchist organizational form of non-hierarchical affinity groups. The hardest entry was under terrorism, and in fact I had taken it out in the summer because, again, it's so much a kind of free-floating signifier. It's almost impossible to get kind of critical purchase on the word terrorism. And the way that Chomsky deals with it is something you might be want to kind of discuss. It turns out, I realize now looking at the glossary, that it's the longest entry. It bears the marks of the moment of its composition or recomposition in October of last year. And it's, in that sense, it's a bit clotted and the least Beercian, but never mind. For what it's worth, here is the entry. The strategic use of violence against civilians, typically by states, but also by those thinking like a state, however marginal and poor in resources. Terrorism seeks to kill and maim, but also more widely to demoralize, to spread the message that no one is safe. Terrorism is an act of communication. It aims to breed rumor, to grab headlines, burn an image of pain and horror in the citizenry's collective skull. The tactic is cost-effective and has had successes. Colonial occupiers have given up and gone home in the face of it. Whether victimization and the sowing of mass paranoia can ever provide the basis for a revolution, that is, the release and refocusing of repressed social energies, is another question. Whereas terror is often disavowed, though in fact inherent to rapine, slavery, inquisition, and colonialism, terrorism lives on the oxygen of publicity. It took modern form with the Jacobin spectacular use of Dr. Guillotin's Enlightenment machine for rational decapitation. The next fin de siècle burst of propaganda by the deed, political assassinations, bombings, and incendiarism, often in fact the work of agents provocateurs in the service of the state's need to justify the deployment of its own hegemonic violence, turned out to be just a curtain raiser for the 20th century, which witnessed the apotheosis of terrorism. I speak too soon, perhaps. Its emblematic instruments have been in the industrialized North, the car bomb, and in the Third World, disappearances and the death squad. But 20th century terrorism's hallmark was bombardment from the air, the Damoclean threat of mass death aimed at the inhabitants of cities, Guernica, London, Dresden, and the ground zero of globalized atomic terror, Hiroshima. For keepers of nuclear stockpiles, to declare a war on terrorism places them very deep in Orwell's debt. In public rhetoric, the epithet terrorist is projected only onto others, enemies so designated by authorities wherever. In the US, the term is rapidly proliferating to implicate all resistance to capitalist globalization, foreign and domestic. Thus, fast-track free trade legislation, corporate bailouts, and environmental deregulation are called counter-terrorism measures. Not for the first time is terrorist, quote, compare Luddite and communist, being forged as a weapon in capitalism's arsenal. Let me just finish on a note that might suggest a conversation that isn't simply, as it were, on the terrain of the opponents, but raises questions about what kind of world we would intend to inhabit and its relations to the vision of the World Trade Organization, IMF, and our masters in general. There's a very fine essay in here by James Connor called On Populism and the Anti-Globalization Movement, and he has a very good sort of potted history of what he takes to be the movement, and then asks, you know, in a positive way, what's the difference between populists and sort of NGO types and a truly radical take on the current situation? And he says something I think that's quite helpful. Here's how he finishes. What's difficult is to prioritize economic growth, quote, that's to say capitalist accumulation, as the indispensable condition for poverty reduction. And of course, this is the song that capitalists sing to themselves, that the way out of poverty is through capitalist accumulation. Translated, this means, quote, there will be no redistribution of wealth, monetary, physical, ecological, or any other kind. The best we can do is to increase growth rates, then target the poor for a goodly share of the increments to growth. How? Of course, by turning the poor into human capital. However, if you think about it, writes Jim O'Connor, poverty can be abolished in a few months, assuming the political will and the economic and ecological resources. First step, make poverty abolition the basic goal of international politics. Second step, allocate some billions of dollars of World Bank, IMF, Regional Development Bank, and other monies to the task at hand. Third step,
employ these monies not for human capital or any other kind of capital, but to use local biomass for building homes, schools, and the rest. We could make a list as long as our arms. Paying public health and medical technicians, teachers of the pedagogy of the oppressed variety, psychologists of the Fanon type, planners of the Kerala variety, and organizers of the type presently engaged in the anti-globalist movement, including some NGO people, perhaps. I borrow, by the way, Antonio Negri's wicked definition of NGOs, the mendicant orders of late capitalism. And more, he says, but you get the idea. Then choose investment projects not in terms of EIRs, environmental impact reports, that seek to minimize damage to local or regional ecologies, but rather to maximize ecological values, community values, cultural values, public health values, and so on. A simple reversal of existing capitalist values and investment criteria. Not safe food, but nourishing food. Not adequate housing, but excellent housing. Not mass transport, but public transit of different types that are a pleasure to use. Obviously not chemical-laced agriculture, but pesticide-free agronomy. Not food monopolies, but farm-to-market global distribution. The tragedy is that so many people know what is to be done, based on tens of thousands of local and regional experiments and practices, not least, of course, in Ithaca. From the allocation of water to the production and allocation of steel. Yet we can do little to make a world in which use value subordinates exchange value and concrete labor subordinates abstract labor, given the present-day monopoly of power by capital markets, the capitalist state, and capitalist international agencies. Just suppose, Jim says, the IMF, the World Bank et al. Were reduced to the status of the International Health Organization, of the International Labour Organization, and other branches of what we might call the international people state, while the latter's power was expanded to the level of the present-day World Bank and IMF. That would be something, wouldn't it? The problem, of course, is not a technical one, a practical problem, but a political problem. The problem of capitalist power in and outside the markets. No movement can challenge capitalist power with success without adopting its own political aims and alternatives. That seems to me a very powerful formulation. But I will take, I'm ready to engage with some naysayers. Yes.
As I've seen the media is having a field day with, you know, with the inability at times for those who are assembling to define their goals.
Mm-hmm.
You just, you know, pointed to some very precise defined goals that was Jim O'Connor.
One of the jobs that I've taken on as a historian is to reanimate, you know, ways of life, ways and communal ways and, you know, histories that have been suppressed, that they're sort of too painful in a way. E.P. Thompson, at the end of his life, said he sort of lost faith in, I think, in the future, and he found himself saying that his own work was in a way like a bottle thrown into the teeth of a storm, sent into the future, washing up who knows where, which would at least show that other conscious, you know, that another consciousness was possible rather than the one defined by the market. That's a long reply to what's a good question. Lynn.
Ian, as a historian, what parallels do you see between this present period and any in the past, if you do?
Mm.
Parallels or differences?
I immediately think to the work that I did with my just called workers, you know, was supposed to document the passing of labor, you know, the end of back-breaking work around the globe. And of course, I don't know, many of you perhaps will have seen the exhibit when it traveled all over and you could buy the book for $100 a pop. You know, exactly why the bourgeoisie would love to see Salgado's book about back-breaking labor is an interesting question. But far from, of course, documenting the end of labor, I mean, it was clear that we're moving into a world in which it's not the end of labor at all. For half the world's population, they're just entering the 19th century. So what's interesting here is that there are different temporalities at work even as we speak. Primitive accumulation is continuing. The expropriation of people who live by subsistence. I mean, the catastrophe of the privatization of the world's germplasm is that, of course, the implications of the commodification of seed is profound, because the seed, of course, is a Janus-faced object. It's both means of production and product. When we crush it to eat it as the staff of life, that's different from when we save the seed and plant it for the next year. I mean, it's a really profound assault. In that sense, it's new. So I would say to Lynn that my interest is in looking at the Coasean logic as it's playing out across different domains. So I say one thing, that no, we don't live in a new world in that sense. Jeremy Rifkin and co. describing a world in which there is no labor, you know, that the computer has changed everything. This is rubbish. Okay, so in that sense, we live, for many people, in a world of, you know, primitive accumulation, of the expropriation, as Marx said, written in letters of blood and fire. But at the same time, we're moving into a terrain, an extraordinary terrain, which is happening. It's moving very fast, and the struggle, it seems to me, has to be very precise and clear. At the beginning of the 20th century, early in the 20th century, certain scientists made proprietary claims about elements that they were discovering. It was turned down. How could you possibly patent a natural product? Couldn't do it. By the end of the century, what's happening? It's become completely routine that patents are granted on life products and life fragments, genetic materials. Okay? A key line at the Supreme Court decision in the Chakravarti case around 1980 was an astounding line, which went something like, "The fact that microorganisms are alive is of no legal significance." When you've moved into a world in which judges are granting intellectual property rights, are assisting in the enclosure, in the Coasean sense, of what is left of the commons, and indeed I'm very aware of standing in a public library. The public library is probably the last public space in America that you could get people to mobilize around. I mean, there's almost nothing left. There is still tremendous fund of goodwill for all kinds of ghastly reasons about, you know, remembering how your grandparents pulled themselves up by the bootstraps. That's not ghastly, but I mean, you know, in other words, there's a kind of romance here about the public library. But I think it's really important to understand this process of privatization. So again, in answer to this, you know, what I think is a very important question, we are both facing things that are radically new and need to be absolutely contested, but also at the same time things which are as old as the first primitive accumulation, which continues. It was I quote one of my favorite quotes from Rousseau on civil society here. Maybe I should read the whole entry because it's relevant to this question. Civil society, these are the key words. Community, stakeholder, participation, transparency, empowerment. These are the grisly fetish words of foundation officers, non-profit apparatchiks, and boardrooms everywhere. Echoed in the field by the NGO cadres busy producing locals. These liberal shibboleths that cluster under the heading of civil society name simulacra of the social and disclose only its disappearance. Not for the first time, at the turn of the 19th century, romantic schoolmasters and antiquarians, the clerisy of European nationalisms, celebrated the folk at the very moment its extinction was guaranteed by enclosure of the commons and the criminalization of custom. It was the proto-romantic Rousseau who remarked, quote, "The first person who, having fenced off a plot of land, took it into his head to say, 'This is mine,' and found people simple enough to believe him, was the true founder of civil society." Beautiful. So that's what we face. It's extremely serious. But notice that there are still plenty of commoners on the earth, contra what both left and right tell you, that work is over, that there are no peasants. The English have always had trouble with peasants. It starts in the Channel. The French have them, but not the English. There were still peasants in 1900, making substantial subsistence from the commons, from the right of estover, panage, pasturage. You know, the bounty of nature was there. Okay, well, I think we've got some things out on the table. Thank you all for coming very much.
That was Ian Bull speaking last week in Ithaca on the Battle of Seattle, a new book on the rise of the anti-globalization movement. We'll close with a commentary from Dr. Blaise Montpain, founder of the Office of the Americas, a human rights organization based in Los Angeles.
The history of mutiny is a history of consciousness. The study of mutiny is far more instructive than the study of imperial victories. But history is written by the victors, so students suffer from the boredom of unrestrained triumphalism. Mutiny in the Civil War was massive on both sides. Yankee immigrants, who did not have $300 to buy their way out of the draft, were resentful. Many left their ranks to seek meaningful employment. Mutiny was massive in World War I. General Pershing ordered his officers to execute the deserters. Pershing's officers did not comply. General Eisenhower approved the desertion execution of Private Slovak in World War II. Mutiny is punished by death in absolutist structures. It is simply the doctrine of infallibility as applied to the state. The mutinous and deserters of the Korean War may still be found in various parts of Asia. The mutiny in Vietnam was an indelible rejection of United States policy. Orders were ignored, officers were assassinated by their own troops. A mutation had taken place in the concept of a soldier as a robot. Soldiers became conscious of how they were being used. Why have we deprived students of the history of mutiny? It seems we are afraid they too might break from an absolutist obedience to tyranny. Mutiny is a substantive component of world history. It must not be ignored. A sharp example of mutiny took place before the Civil War. It was the mutiny of the San Patricio Battalion in 1846, the war with Mexico. The war was a vicious conquest of Mexico, not by Spain, but by the United States. Abe Lincoln opposed the war with Mexico, saying that our troops were killed on Mexican soil as aggressors. Ulysses S. Grant described the war with Mexico as the most unjust ever waged by a stronger nation against a weaker nation. Robert E. Lee expressed similar sentiments. President Polk was full of fundamentalist manifest destiny and dreamt about taking everything down to Mexico City. The war ended in 1848, with the United States generously taking only half of Mexico. The Irish immigrants who fled the potato famine in their country came to the United States and were quickly inducted into the United States Army to vanquish Mexico. But United States Captain John Riley, formerly of County Galway, analyzed the situation and determined that this was a war of aggression against the Mexican people. He saw in the Mexicans the same love, the same hospitality, and the same church he had left in Ireland. Why should he fight these beautiful people? He brought his battalion to the Mexican side and fought against the invading gringos. Mexico honors the San Patricio Battalion every year. Ireland honors the San Patricio Battalion every year. We will honor them once we prefer critical thinking to absolutist conformity. The history of mutiny is a reflection of the history of consciousness. Mutiny is not a tragedy. The tragedy is that we feed our young people an endless diet of triumphal material and allow them to be deprived of a truth that hurts and liberates. This is Blaise Bonpain.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, You can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.